You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today we start in the Florence area, a few exits south of LA City Hall off the 110 freeway, on a quiet street of houses. One of those houses is yellow, with a second house behind it on the same lot. The front lawn is full of flowers and a big vine-like fruit plant. It's not blooming right now, but
in the summers we get granadillas, which is great for juice. We love making granadilla juice, and it's so nice to come outside and sit here under the plant.
Andrea Galdamez lives here with three generations of her family.
Hola, abuela, ¿cómo está? ¿Se siente bien?
Now, if you're a longtime listener to this show, you might remember Andrea. A couple of years ago, she brought Greater LA along to her senior prom at Roosevelt High School. Remember that one? It's online if you want to check. That fall, she went off to UC Irvine. But after the pandemic hit, she returned here to her childhood home to study remotely. It's not always easy to concentrate in a big multi-generational household. Nine people all together between the two houses.
Like, I'm trying to do homework in the dining room, and they're like, oh my gosh, go to your room because we want to eat. And I'm like, I was here first.
Still, life at home was mostly comfortable, was the key word, until COVID-19 came into the picture.
The first person who got infected was me, actually, which was hard because I felt super guilty.
Throughout Los Angeles, Latino residents like Andrea and her relatives face the deadliest risk from COVID-19. According to recent county public health data, they're nearly three times more likely to die from the virus than white Angelenos. Black and Asian residents are also dying at higher rates. And the poorer you are, the more dangerous the virus. Well, housing is one part of what's behind these deep disparities. And KCRW's reporter Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness, joins us right now to talk about it. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
So it is housing, but it's a lot of other things too, right?
Yes, absolutely. As this pandemic has dragged on and on, it has more and more revealed and even made worse the racial and economic inequality that was already there. And one person I talked to who's researched this is USC professor Manuel Pastor, and he described this progression.
The disease originally had a pretty significant impact on more white folks because it was in senior homes, and the older population is whiter in America, and in particular in California. And also because the folks who had the most likelihood of coming into contact with the infection were people who had either been traveling or interacting with international travelers. But as soon as it settled into the United States, it basically found its ways through the valleys of inequality to the low spots of despair.
He says the higher rates of infection and death in communities of color have a lot of causes, everything from unequal access to healthcare and to parks to, in Black communities, the stress of dealing with racism and how that impacts people physically. But some of these causes, like you said, are related to housing, and we're going to go through a couple of those. One risk factor for more deaths is when you have younger family members living with parents and grandparents.
Like Andrea, whom we just heard from.
Yeah, exactly. Because older people are more likely to die if they catch the virus, lots of people live with roommates or spouses who are their own age.
But the odds of someone who is Latino, who's between 20, say 45, living in a multi-generational household with somebody who's older and very vulnerable, that's much more likely.
Not just in Los Angeles, but across the country, Latino, Black, and Asian people are all more likely to live in multi-generational homes than white people. That's according to a study that came out a couple of years ago from the Pew Research Center. In Andrea's case, she says her family all lives together partly for financial reasons, because it's affordable, and also her uncle is their landlord, but also for social reasons. She says they have this big wooden table in the backyard that's kind of part of a family tradition.
I think it goes back to my mom's childhood and my grandma. My family is from El Salvador. When they were young, my mom says that her grandpa was a carpenter. He cut up a big tree and he made this long table for all his 50 grandchildren.
They've kind of recreated that here in LA. So her household includes her grandmother, her step-grandfather, a granduncle, and his wife, so several older people. But still, she wasn't too worried at first when she developed a sore throat a few days before Christmas. She says that she hadn't been leaving the house very much. She didn't think she'd been exposed to COVID-19. She still doesn't know where she got it. But when she got a test, it came back positive. And then her younger sister also tested positive.
We got all the symptoms, but they weren't severe. But then it was so sad and isolating.
This is how she describes her Christmas.
I told my sister, I was like, wow, this is sad. She's like, yeah, it's sad. And then we both went back to sleep.
So it was depressing. They stayed in their room together for 2 weeks. But that was not the end of things. Next, her parents tested positive.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then her aunt started showing symptoms. And then her grandmother started feeling bad.
That's when it hit me. I said, oh, my gosh, my grandma's going to die because of me.
Anna, that is terrifying. Even when you have a room to quarantine in, right? It's hard to control the virus inside a household because the symptoms don't show up right away. Everybody's sort of on top of each other, right?
Yeah, which brings us to the other housing-related risk factor that's driving these unequal outcomes, overcrowded housing. Did you know that LA has a higher percentage of overcrowded homes than any other city in the country?
I did not know that. What do you mean by overcrowded, though? What does that mean?
It means homes with more people than rooms minus bathrooms. That's how the federal government defines overcrowding. And this is another consequence of LA's affordable housing crisis. People cram together because they can't afford more space. One person who sees this a lot is Silvana Naguib. She's a supervising attorney at the pro bono public interest law firm Public Counsel, and she works with a lot of low-income families.
I've often seen clients who have a bedroom set up in the living room. I don't know of any situation in which there is a child that has their own bedroom. That is not something that is a reality for any of our clients in Los Angeles.
And a lot of her clients now are in a catch-22 with COVID-19 because they have essential jobs that can't be done from home. They can't afford to miss work, especially now, because if they can't pay the rent, it's not a good time to turn to family or friends.
Honestly, what I've seen from people who have to move out is I've had clients who moved into living in their cars. Because I think, you know, during the pandemic, who really wants to take on extra people living in their house when you don't have space to begin with?
And Anna, you can really see why denser communities, I mean, places like Pico Union or South Los Angeles, that they're seeing some of LA County's highest infection rates, right?
Right, because a lot of people are sharing small spaces.
So how are Andrea and her family doing now?
So COVID did infect everyone in the household and an uncle who lives about a mile away with his family because he came over to help out when everyone at her house was quarantining. Her step-grandfather was hospitalized for a period of time. So it was a big mess, as she puts it. But the good news is that everyone did recover and they're all doing well now.
One of the things that really, I think, helped our whole family was prayer. I come from like a Christian family, and every night through like Zoom or FaceTime, they join together and they pray with like church members, and not just prayer, but also like talking to one another because you haven't seen all these people in so long and you feel so detached. I think that was very helpful. You know, I think power of prayer, fellowshipping is strong, you know?
That's certainly good news, Anna, that they're doing okay after all of that.
Yes, it's definitely good news.
KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness for us. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In a COVID year of ups and downs, and let's face it, it's been mostly downs, Hollywood appears to be back in business. After the latest shutdown, production crews have now resumed TV and film and commercial shooting after a near month-long hiatus. because of a surge in coronavirus cases in Los Angeles. One of the shows that's back up and running is Mr. Mayor, starring Ted Danson, who plays the chief executive of L.A.
Speech real original.
It actually wasn't.
Small businesses are the lifeblood of this city. Produce is the lifeblood of this city.
Twitter has started to notice that we're recycling speeches.
The passing of Archbishop Sheehan is the lifeblood. You're killing me.
It's a show on NBC that, by the way, wrote COVID into the script. Now, there are countless others, of course, that are back in production. That's good news for sure. Bryn Sandberg is a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter and joins us right now. Hey, Bryn.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. Let's start with Mr. Mayor, which actually picks up when quarantine is over and folks go back to normal everyday life without the masks and the social distancing and things like that. But actually, maybe I should say, ironically, the show had to halt production, right, because of a COVID outbreak.
Yeah, what we are seeing on some productions is that, you know, of course, people, you know, who come on set are also in the community and, you know, they are sometimes exposed to the virus, even when they are taking, you know, precautions, wearing their mask and that sort of thing. And so we did see that in December on Mr. Mayor, and they do their investigation and look at, you know, whoever tests positive. Were they all in the same pod or the same zone on a set, meaning they were working together, or were, you know, did three people test positive all from different zones, meaning there wasn't spread on the actual set, but it was people getting infected in the community and then getting that positive test, and then, of course, being removed. So there is a whole process that happens when there are, you know, positive test results, which do happen. And those people are generally, you know, immediately removed from the set. And then a contact tracing takes place and you figure out, you know, who was in contact, who was possibly exposed. And those people are also, you know, told to quarantine, even if they don't, you know, necessarily show symptoms or have a positive test themselves, just to be safe. But yes, Mr. Mayor was one of those shows, and that happened in December. And my understanding now is that they are back in production and doing regular testing, just like several other projects here in LA.
Talk about how productions have been resuming with these zones.
Yeah, so over the summer, you know, the industry's leading guilds and production company studios got together and developed, you know, a set of strict COVID-19 protocols for productions to be able to resume safely. And part of that was dividing sets into zones. On some sets, they're known as, you know, Zone A, B, and C. Other sets, you know, depending on the studio or the streamer, they're, you know, green zone, yellow zone, red zone. But the idea is the same, no matter what they're called. And it's that, you know, you have certain zones that are stricter. For example, I believe it's called the A zone. That is generally where actors are. And, you know, actors, of course, can't always wear their masks, you know, especially if they're filming a show that doesn't take place during a pandemic. And so they are therefore, you know, more vulnerable. And that's why there's stricter regulations in those areas. So, you know, makeup artists, you know, hair stylists, you know, need to wear a mask and a face shield typically, and, you know, gloves to be extra safe. They also have more frequent testing typically in those zones. And then as you get outside that in zone B or C, say, there's just fewer regulations. And one of those zones is where, you know, you're allowed to eat. You're allowed to pull down your mask so that you can eat or, you know, take a sip of water or whatever it might be, while, of course, you know, keeping your distance from people. But that is sort of one of the ways that the industry has tried to really protect, you know, people when they go back to work.
You mentioned the guilds got together and SAG-AFTRA and others last summer to put this together, right? That had to have been pretty difficult, like getting everybody on board.
Yes, it took several months. and I think there was a lot of, you know, negotiating, and there were a lot of really tough questions that they had to work out. Like, for example, you know, if a crew member tests positive on a set, you know, and they're sent home for 14 days to quarantine, you know, is the studio responsible for paying them during that time when they're not working? Or, you know, questions like that they sort of had to work out a system that you know, was best for everyone and kept people as safe as possible.
You know, during the pandemic, there were a lot of states that were certainly more open than California. And I wonder if production left California during that time, you know, where studios said, hey, we can get things done in Atlanta or we can get things done in Florida because they're open more. Did we see a lot of that?
Well, sure. I think Georgia is a great example that you mentioned. Georgia has had, you know, a really thriving, you know, film economy lately. In the past few years, especially, they've had a lot of big budget features that California had lost out on. They you know, filmed several of the Marvel movies. And so they do a lot of business with the larger studios. And that was a place that we saw. They got up and running pretty quickly. And they, of course, were, you know, waiting on the protocols to, you know, to be finalized, you know, between the studios and the guilds and whatnot. But they also were developing some of these larger production facilities there, were developing their own. I know Pinewood, formerly Pinewood, they were Pinewood Atlanta, and now they're, I believe they're called Trillith. But they have, you know, been home to multiple Marvel movies and some Netflix shows and Disney Plus Marvel shows now. And they, you know, worked very hard to develop their own protocols too, some of which were stricter than the ones put forth by, you know, the industry. You know, things to do with air handling. You know, they were working out how they could make the whole environment there safer. They were trying to move as many things outside as possible, so as to not have a large number of people indoors breathing the same air. They were putting hand washing stations, you know, everywhere. So they were doing their own things to try to draw production in and say, hey, you know, we've got this worked out as best as we can, and this is as safe a working environment as possible right now.
And what about the narrative, you know, over the past decade or so that these productions, many productions, were leaving California or Los Angeles specifically for these other places? I mean, has that changed? Did the pandemic make it worse? Or how is LA doing right now as far as production goes?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Film LA, which is the nonprofit that, you know, tracks filming here in Greater Los Angeles, actually released a report. I believe it was last week, might have been the week before, but they look at the other you know, states, even other countries that are also drawing production and compare it to how California is doing. And according to them, you know, California really does still come out on top as a real, you know, destination for filming still, whether it's a broadcast, you know, network TV show or it's a streaming show. They really do. And part of that just because, you know, this is where a lot of the industry, what they call home and where they live, especially if you're getting, you know, A-list talent, a lot of people will try to negotiate, you know, in their contract that they want to film nearby. And I think the other advantage that I've heard from some of the, you know, local film officials here is that you don't have to travel as far if you do live here, you know, and you are indeed filming here. You don't have to risk getting on a plane or, you know, having to transport a lot of people. But the other areas that we saw do really well during this time were international locations. And we saw them do well early on when you know, the U.S. was grappling with how to, you know, handle the virus. And I know that Jurassic World, the next sequel from Universal, you know, was filming during the summer in the UK, and they had, I believe, rented out a hotel that was sort of served as a bubble for some of their cast and crew. And I think that they felt safer doing it there.
Bryn Sandberg, senior writer for The Hollywood Reporter. Bryn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, finally, before you tell us goodbye, here's a noteworthy end to the show. With the pandemic still raging and a city not staging the spotlight that once it had, the searchlights are quiet, there's an entertainment diet, and the news can make you kinda sad. But don't say any of that to musician and songwriter Bruce Lloyd Cates, born and raised in the City of Angels. He wrote this song a few years back to underscore how special this hodgepodge of sprawl really is, and how unmatched it remains to this day by other cities bigger, mostly smaller. Lonesome for LA is an ode to Los Angeles, one that's not sarcastic like that other more famous song, you know, the one where you're supposed to love it, or songs about bridges or taco trucks and the like. All good songs, by the way. His is a musical feeling of being here and never leaving, going all in L.A.
New York was a kick, but my poor legs and feet got sore kind of quick. In Boston was all that history they got. I missed quite a lot, it's true. But my life seems to feel off track, and I guess what I really lack is a semi-tropical place I've long called my home, and where I've got to get back.
I was a piano technician all my life. I'm retired now. And I went into a lot of homes and met people of every sort and was able to socialize somewhat with them and get to know about their lives. And I'm just very rooted here. What can I tell you? If I go somewhere, you know, whether it be, Paris or Quebec, I haven't traveled that much. Whenever I have, it only takes me about a day or so when I feel that pull to go back to my home.
But I'm lonesome for L.A. That's where I'd always been so at ease. Loved a free kind of feeling there, where people survive off their fantasies.
You know, whatever I write tends to be not very much in step with anything current. It goes back to my parents and my uncle, who came of age during the Great Depression. And they were musicians back in that pre-television time, where every corner bar would have some piano, and people went out, you know, in evenings. And there would be maybe a pianist or maybe several musicians who knew all the old tunes of that time, you know, that Tin Pan Alley stuff. And customers would dance and maybe throw a few coins in the kitty for tips. My dad would come home in the early hours of the morning with maybe, first of all, they'd pay you $3. Which was a considerable amount of money at that time. You could buy a tuna sandwich for 10 cents. A full meal with coffee and dessert would come to 35 cents. And he was able to support himself. That was really something at a time when all of his friends were out of work. So that's the music that I heard when I was just a baby growing up.
People will put me down. So what? What else is new? For they underrate my town. It's almost a hip thing to do.
Well, you know, LA is not an easy place to write it about, because in contrast to other big cities, there isn't this central core idea. So you search around for something. What are you going to write about, Pershing Square? So my central core idea is simply my nostalgia. I am this type of guy who gets lonesome for L.A., what can I tell you? And that's my central core idea. So I built my song around that, and I dedicated it to the memory of my beloved parents, Ethel and Arthur Cates, who came here during the Depression from Minneapolis. And they hitched a trailer to their old Buick and got on Highway Route 66 and made it down here to L.A. And when they got here, they thought they were dreaming when they saw palm trees swaying in the gentle breezes of midwinter.
The traffic can knock you out. You blow half your life in a car. And some of those drivers, no doubt, are smoking something bizarre. Why should I waste my time? Make believe. believe and I feel okay, when the fact is I feel like I am getting lonesome for L.A. Say, would you believe that I am getting lonesome for L.A.? Hey, call me a crashing bore, but I'm lonesome for L.A.
Singer-songwriter Bruce Lloyd Cates and his song Lonesome for L.A. We're going to have a link to that song on the website. You'll find it at kcrw.com/greaterLA. There, you can also subscribe to the podcast, too. Get it to your feed every day. And tell us how you're doing, too, at kcrw.com/greaterLA. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, school is still out in many parts of California for COVID. How that's been affecting kids and parents and teachers. Thanks this evening to Jenna Kegel, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamit, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl. And thank you for your ears and attention tonight. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great evening.